I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's news today that the Obama administration is considering a new tax or fee on big banks to recoup possibly as much as $120 billion in lost bailout money and cut the federal deficit. The idea is still being debated among administration officials, but some new levies on financial firms are expected to be part of the budget the White House submits to Congress on February 2nd. This comes as top Wall Street CEOs prepare to testify tomorrow before that new commission, headed by former California Treasurer Phil Angelides, and charged with looking into the financial crisis. Binyamin Applebaum is banking reporter for The Washington Post. Binya, before we get to the White House plan, there's even more news. You've just come out of a meeting at the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They already charge banks fees. That's how it works. So explain how it works and what's today's news.
Yeah, that's right. The FDIC collects fees from all banks to repay depositors in failed banks. And what they did today was they voted to consider a proposal that would increase the fees that they collect from banks that pay employees in ways that the FDIC considers risky, basically compensation practices that focus on short-term performance rather than long-term results.
Is this a big deal, do you think?
It could be. You know, we're still in the early stages of this discussion, but there are a growing number of proposals in Washington to tax banks in various ways as a means of getting them to change their behavior. And certainly the sum total of those proposals adds up to a lot of money and really could have an impact on the way that the banking business operates.
So the FDIC is calling for compensation policies that were based more on long-term success than short-term. How about other things like clawback options?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's three parts to this proposal. The first would encourage banks to compensate employees mostly with stock that they cannot sell immediately. It would also encourage them to include what are called clawback provisions, which allow the bank to recoup a portion of the bonus if the things that the employee was rewarded for end up sort of going sour in the long term. If what looked like a good deal becomes a bad deal, the bank can go back to the employee and get some of that money back. And finally, they want these decisions to be made by independent members of the company's board of directors.
Well, meanwhile, the White House, as we said, is also debating different ideas for new levies on big banks. One of them would be a one-time fee, maybe determined by the size of the bank or the overall risk of the bank's portfolio. What are some of the other White House ideas?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the major one, and that seems the one that's most likely to come out of the White House. There's a couple of other ideas kicking around in Congress in particular. One of them is the notion of a transaction tax, a fee that would be collected every time stocks or bonds or other financial instruments change hands. That's something we've had in the past. We abolished it in the 1960s, but it's being talked about again. Another idea is a tax on bonuses, like the one that England has imposed on its bankers.
50%. 50%. Britain taxes 50% of all bonuses over $40,000.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite a hit. It's intended to really make a statement, and to judge from the squawking over in England, it really has.
Well, not everybody here is on board with this idea of fines and taxes and levies. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner opposes it. He says banks would just charge their customers more. And there's that concern, but also there's some grumbling that banks might use this as an excuse not to give out loans. You know, we're being taxed. We can't. So what's the downside?
You know, those are the downsides. The first one, as you said, is this concern that almost anything you do to the financial industry is going to be passed through in whole or in part to its customers. And basically, you'll end up punishing the broader economy rather than the financial sector. Similarly, banks say if you do succeed in increasing their costs, if you do succeed in making the fees stick to them and they can't pass it through to their customers, it will just make them weaker and they'll be less able to lend, less able to perform what they view as important services for the broader economy. This is a concern that some senior members of the administration, including the Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, absolutely share. And it's made the administration reluctant to pursue these approaches.
Well, but as you and others have been reporting, there's such public outrage at bonuses. The White House, some people felt, had to do something. That's Binyamin Applebaum, banking reporter for The Washington Post. We'll check back in with you to see how these unfold. Thanks, Binya.
Thank you.
Humam Khalil Abu Malal al-Balawi assumed many identities. To his family in Jordan, he was a doctor. On the internet, he called himself Abu Dujana and was one of the most celebrated anti-West commentators online. Jordanian intelligence officers thought he was one of them, and they wanted him to meet Americans. But Balawi turned out to be a double agent, and as we now know, last month he blew himself up, killing 7 CIA agents and a Jordan intelligence officer in Afghanistan. Today we want to take a look at the hazards of double agents with someone who's been on the front lines. Peter Ernest is executive director of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. He worked for the CIA's clandestine service during his 36 years with the agency. He recruited agents to provide intelligence from other countries. He dealt with double agents and uncovered one. Peter Ernest, welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me.
What constitutes a double agent in your mind?
Well, even professional intelligence officers get to arguing about whether someone's a double or not. Mm-hmm. But classically, a double agent is simply someone who is an agent, meaning not a staff officer, but they've been recruited or volunteered, that is working for an intelligence service and is turned back against the intelligence service by another service or individuals. So we can certainly look at a classic case of a double agent in the case of Dr. al-Balawi. He was recruited by the Jordanians, ostensibly, to run against al-Qaeda. Seemingly it was successful, and so a meeting was arranged with CIA officers. And at that meeting, as we now know, he committed suicide, blew himself up, and killed some 8 individuals.
Because he was working for al-Qaeda.
Because he had been run by al-Qaeda against the Americans. Now, we don't know what his original intention was. Even when the Jordanians recruited him, did he actually, in the back of his mind, plan really to work with al-Qaeda and to try and do damage to the Jordanians or Americans? Or was he sincere in cooperating with the Jordanians, but al-Qaeda turned him, that is, doubled him, back against the Jordanians and Americans? That's exactly what a double agent is.
How would you determine this? If someone came to you and presented themselves to you at the CIA as someone who worked for another agency, let's say maybe it was the Soviet Union at that time, and wanted to flip, how would you trust them? And conversely, how would you go about trying to recruit somebody?
Well, when you're in counterintelligence work, you're trying to determine whether the information that they're giving you has value. In other words, is this just a bunch of garbage, or does it have real value? Because if they're being run against you, they might not want to give you something of value. On the other hand, they may want to bait you, as it were. And so there are different ways. You're continually gauging the information you're being given. We have often used polygraphs with people who were working with us, as well as on our own staff personnel. That's one of the means. The other is, you may have sources that are also reporting on this individual, and you can gather some information about them that way.
You actually helped uncover a double agent. How?
Well, it was simply someone who was one of our most productive assets, and I noticed in some of the reporting that it resembled reporting we'd received elsewhere.
Why would that alarm you? I would think it would confirm for you that he had a source, a good source. Why would that alarm you?
That's a good question. It wasn't simply that the information, let's say, meshed with other information, but it actually duplicated it, which suggested that somebody was working from mimeographed copy or something. In other words, there were at least 2 assets here who were reporting almost precisely the same thing.
So somebody was feeding it to them.
Yeah, and it wasn't a question of where they had copied documents. It was actually, you know, original writing.
So what'd you do?
In this case, I actually had to mount an operation against my own agent. Now, this was not an American. This was a foreigner. This is sort of Bond stuff, but I was in a tuxedo, and I had to gain access to his office, lie on my back, and plant a bug inside his desk, which I did with a silent drill, ending up with sawdust on my tux, which I had to collect, put in a pocket, and leave the bug and rejoin the party. It was very successful. Over the ensuing weeks, we actually were able to hear him meeting with another service.
What was the other service?
An East European service.
It seems that something's profoundly different now than it was 20, 30 years ago when there was a double agent. Not that it wasn't very dangerous when there was a double agent 20, 30 years ago, but as you observe it now, with not just maybe political ideology driving agents, but fundamentalist ideology driving agents, what's your thinking?
No, you've certainly put your finger right on it. The fundamental difference is that was an adversarial relationship between states, between America and the Soviet Union, but we were not trying to kill each other. We were trying to do all sorts of things to manipulate, confuse, recruit, embarrass, whatever, our adversaries. And certainly in the course of the Cold War, some people died, but not as the result of assassination in the sense that we're dealing with today. in that the extremists, the Islamic extremists, have declared it an object to kill Americans, not just CIA people, but to kill Americans. It's one of the objectives of al-Qaeda.
By and large, why do most agents flip?
If you look back at the Cold War, the beginnings of the Cold War, certainly many of the people who were working for the Russian or Soviet intelligence services were driven by ideology. They believed in communism. If you look at some of the recent American traitors like Rick Ames and Robert Hansen, they were working for money. There was no ideology involved there.
I would think if somebody only wants to make money and isn't driven by some sort of personal belief or passion, that'd be easier to flip them. Actually, let's stay with Aldrich Ames. Didn't he work for you?
Yes, Ames worked for me. The one thing I have to tell you right off the bat is he did not have the word spy inscribed on his forehead. People often say, well, how come you couldn't tell he was a spy? Well, because you can't, because the role of a spy is to look like everyone else. Ames was had worked for me on one of our very important cases, and that was the highest level Soviet defector we ever had in this country, the Undersecretary of the UN, Arkady Shevchenko. Ames was a Russian speaker, and so he was very helpful in setting up debriefings and so forth.
Well, and we understand that, you know, he started doing odd jobs at the CIA when he was in high school. After college, he signed on full-time, so he's well-known, sort of a member of the family, if you will. What made him turn? I mean, he ultimately received almost $4.5 million for selling services to the Soviet Union. Why did he flip?
What happened with Rick Ames, his marriage came apart. He then went to Mexico, where he met the woman he would later marry, Rosario. And she was a woman that needed a great deal of money to enjoy the good life. And so when he returned to the States, he knew the Soviet service, and he literally walked into the Soviet embassy and volunteered his services. We sometimes call people like this walk-ins because they volunteer. He literally walked into the Soviet embassy here on 16th Street and volunteered to be a covert penetration of CIA for them. And in so doing, over the course of his cooperation, he compromised an enormous amount of material. We know of at least 10 Soviets who had been cooperating with us who were tried and executed. We know he compromised some 100 other operations. He was very, very knowledgeable of our operations.
Well, and we understand that those 10 other double agents, the Soviets that Aldrich Ames turned in, snitched on, were executed, murdered. That's more than the Jordanian double agent killed in Afghanistan. We know the CIA is reeling because of that today, so we want to ask you, Peter, how it felt back then. Peter Ernest is executive director of the International Spy Museum in D.C. and a former officer in the CIA's clandestine service. We're going to have more with him. Also, later today, the swine flu. Officials are warning of a third wave, so why aren't people getting vaccines? That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Peter Ernest, executive director of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and a former CIA officer. We're talking about double agents in the aftermath of the Jordanian who last month killed 7 CIA officers and a Jordanian intelligence officer. And Peter, we were talking about Aldrich or Rick Ames. He made $4.5 million selling secrets to the Soviets, and the information he gave them resulted in at least 10 agents' deaths. And I'm thinking, doesn't that make him a metaphorical suicide bomber?
Whatever you might say about al-Balawi, he did it for religious extremist views. Ames' views were far more crass. They were for money.
Well, he flipped a coin almost. Should I rob a bank or sell U.S. secrets to the Soviets? I'll sell U.S. secrets to the Soviets, and that's what he did. What does that do for someone like you when that's revealed in 1994 when he was finally caught? What's your stomach doing at that point?
It was a profound shock to me. One of the things that's characteristic of this work It is a band of brothers and sisters. We're all in this together. We're in the front lines, and there's a very, very high degree of trust. You may not like everybody you're working with, but there's a bond of trust. And when that's violated, it's a profound shock. And that's an experience and an emotion I shared with a friend of mine who was in the FBI and knew Robert Hansen very well. And Hansen was a case almost parallel to Ames in that he was a walk-in. He volunteered to the Soviets and did extraordinary damage to U.S. interests.
This is the man who was caught by the FBI at a drop spot in Virginia in 2001. When he was caught, he said, "What took you so long?" He knew he might be. So these are cases of U.S. CIA officers who, for largely financial reasons, decided to cross over. But it seems like historically governments are the ones who try to get people to be double agents. We understand the British were notorious for turning German agents and then using them to plant false information with the Germans. Bob Mackey, a retired Army colonel and terrorism consultant, writes that Juan Pujol of Spain was probably one of the greatest double agents ever.
Pujol, who was given the codename Garbo by the British because he was such a good actor, so I'll call him Garbo, was a young, unemployed fellow of no particular background, but he detested Franco, and he wanted to do whatever he could to hurt him, volunteer to be a spy or something. And he approached the British, and they turned him down because he had no access. No. He didn't represent anything. So he then went to the Germans and volunteered to be a spy and said he could provide information on Great Britain. They scarfed it up. So they picked him up. He became a German agent. He then began giving them information, all of which he got out of the newspaper.
He made it up or got it out of a newspaper.
He got it from open sources. And now that he was employed by the Germans, he went back to the British. And because he was now had a relationship with the Germans, the British then picked him up.
Wow.
He was working for both services, but he was now, his true loyalty was to the British. And perhaps one of his greatest contributions was he was part of our deception of the Germans as to where and when D-Day would take place, 6 June 1944, the invasion.
Because Pujol convinced the Nazis that there were 75 Allied divisions in Great Britain already, these extra divisions.
Correct.
And so Hitler said, "Well, I've got to keep all my troops over in this area looking at this." So he was able to distract Hitler and have Hitler move his troops while Allied troops liberated Paris.
Exactly. And I think one thing that you always have to keep in mind, Garbo's activities alone didn't do that. There were a number of other deception things that were done. So that intelligence may not play the critical role, but it often is a powerful contributory factor.
He was given both the Iron Cross by the Nazis, who really believed that he had alerted them to these 75 Allied divisions, and he was also awarded the MBE by the British government, who knew that he had tricked the Nazis and helped Allied troops liberate Paris. And the Germans never knew the truth until the 80s, 1980s.
That's right. They didn't know until long after. You know, he gave them information that was just nuanced enough, just shaded enough, and gotten to them late enough that it truly didn't help them. But it was valuable if they had had it in time. And that was part of the deception.
So, Peter Ernest, do you think that with the new enemy that the U.S. faces, do you think they're maybe rethinking a double agent program?
Not rethinking it. Agents, espionage, double agents are classic aspects of intelligence and this kind of work, subversion. And so it's not going to go away. Both sides will practice it to an extent. Both sides will try and uncover the other's double agents. What is new, I think, for all those dealing with this Islamic fundamentalism, the extremists, is precisely that factor, that you are dealing with a very lethal weapon, you know, the lethal weapon of suicide, and people willing to just simply destroy their own lives and others in pursuit of their goals and support of their beliefs.
Something that was driven home by the terrible events that took at least 7 CIA officers, your former colleagues in Afghanistan. Peter Ernest, former CIA officer, one last question for you. We know you've written a forthcoming book for young adults. It's called The Real Spy's Guide to Being a Spy. It's a real advice manual. And we know you come into contact with a lot of young people there at the International Spy Museum in Washington. What do they ask you?
So often their questions are, you know, well, what should I study in school? Or supposing I've gotten in trouble or something? Or where should I apply? All these kinds of sort of very basic questions that might come up all the way from middle school to high school on into college. And I just try and address them, give them some feel for what the intelligence community is about. And there's places in the intelligence community for all sorts of people, including you.
With, I don't know.
With your background.
Blabbermouth here.
journalism and so forth.
Can't keep a secret here.
of your background would often make great intelligence officers.
Well, Peter, perhaps I'll call you down the road, but thank you so much for talking to us about, you know, for many, it's a romanticized subject, but as we can see, it's a deadly serious one as well. Thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Abortion rights opponents and supporters are closely watching the trial of Scott Roeder, the man accused of killing abortion provider Dr. George Tiller last year in the foyer of Tiller's church in Wichita, Kansas. Roeder has confessed to the killing, and many thought it would be an open and shut murder case. Then this past Friday, Roeder's attorneys asked Judge Warren Wilbert to allow them to use a defense similar to the necessity defense that would allow him to explain why he killed and reduce his charge to voluntary manslaughter. And Judge Wilbert said he'd consider it. Well, that's turned the trial on its head. Jury selection is on hold until tomorrow, while prosecutors try to convince the judge to change his mind. Judy Thomas of the Kansas City Star has been covering this story since the first protest at George Tiller's clinic back in 1991. She's co-author of the 1998 book, Wrath of Angels, The American Abortion War. So, Judy, Roeder is claiming his actions were justified. Explain the defense, and this would be the first time it would be allowed in a trial of this kind.
Yes, what they are arguing, actually there is no question. Roeder himself has confessed to us and to the Associated Press that he did indeed kill Dr. Tiller. So that is not the question here. The question that he wants to present, or the issue he wants to address, is why he did it. And that's what's going on in court right now. On December 22nd, Judge Wilbert ruled that he could not use the necessity defense. He said that was not recognized by Kansas law. But he did leave the door open for a defense that is, and that's defense of others, which is very similar to the necessity defense, where Roeder would argue that I killed Dr. Tiller to save unborn babies, is what he's saying.
Well, what are prosecutors saying in response?
Well, prosecutors are saying that if the judge allows this kind of a defense, that that would be putting Dr. Tiller on trial and that it could lead to lawlessness, because this has never been done before.
Well, we understand one of the problems with the necessity defense is that an attacker must have an actual fear of imminent attack. And Dr. Tiller wasn't in his clinic about to perform an abortion. He was in church where he was an usher. So does this defense of others sort of give Roeder a possible broader defense?
You're correct. Defense of others, according to Kansas statute, requires that someone is preventing the imminent use of unlawful force. There are two different issues. They're imminent. Dr. Tiller being in church and being shot in the back of the church, the argument is that is definitely not imminent. And then unlawful force. Dr. Tiller was providing abortions, which is the argument is they are constitutionally protected. There's always been a question of whether Dr. Tiller was performing illegal abortions, but that has been tried in court as recently as this past March, and Dr. Tiller was acquitted. But there are all those issues in the background, and those are the kinds of things that Scott Roeder would like to bring to the trial.
Well, meanwhile, what are you hearing from abortion providers across the country first, and then opponents of abortion?
Well, I got an email from one just yesterday who is in this area saying that if the judge allows this, it would be open season on doctors. So there is a huge concern that this will become a rallying point, if you will, and a lot of these activists would come to the trial, and that there is a fear of that.
Well, and then on the other side, we know opponents of choice and of abortion are saying other killers have not been allowed to explain why they did what they did, and so they're hoping that Roeder gets to do just that. But again, prosecutors are saying, well, then anyone could justify a killing for an emotionally charged political belief.
Exactly.
Well, meanwhile, jury selection has been pushed back. It's now supposed to begin tomorrow. And writers, including one on the Huffington Post, quoting your book and reminding us how much an abortion battleground Kansas has been with leading anti-abortion groups based there. Many writers are concerned that some of those opponents might make their way to the jury. Is there a concern about getting a jury, also, I guess, from the other side's point of view, that his fellow church members are in this area as well.
I think the big concern is getting a jury that is not biased. The judge has closed the jury selection, and we are fighting that right now, because they have issued or given all the jurors a questionnaire that's very detailed and asks very sensitive questions of the jurors, including their thoughts about abortion and whether they knew Dr. Tiller. And they said the jurors won't be as candid if the media were in there. So it's a very sensitive selection process. And what Roeder is hoping for, and his supporters I've talked to are hoping, that there will be one or two people on the jury who get on there and decide that they're going to rule according to their thoughts, and if they think that abortion is murder, they're not going to vote to convict.
Judy Thomas, reporter for the Kansas City Star, co-author of the 1998 book, Wrath of Angels, The American Abortion War. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, the H1N1 vaccine is widely available, but are people getting it? 30 seconds, here and now. Across the country, health officials are warning of a third wave of H1N1, even though the number of reported cases of swine flu is down significantly from its peak in October. The message is, get vaccinated. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, are people responding to that message? We sent Here Now's George Hicks to a neighborhood pharmacy in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hi, I'm here to get a flu shot.
He's right there in the side.
Okay.
See if he can give you one.
Are you waiting for a flu shot?
Yeah.
I thought you were shopping for birthday cards.
No. She's like, go stand over there. I'm like, really? I give shots right here?
Would you mind telling me your name?
I'm Hillary Majeska.
What made you decide to come in today?
Yeah, I had a lot of friends who got swine flu, and glad that I haven't gotten sick yet. So
if you do, at least you'll know it isn't the swine flu.
Exactly.
Have you had your seasonal flu
shot?
Yep.
I get those every year. I love the flu shot. I don't know if it's true or not, but I feel like I get less colds.
So the placebo effect is really...
I know, that's true. So
thing.
I just keep telling myself that. Hi.
My name is Brian DeRosiers. I'm a pharmacist here at Inman Pharmacy. So two forms we need to have you fill out. The first is a screening questionnaire, and the second is just a consent form for the vaccinations. The nasal vaccine is actually a live vaccine.
Are you doing the shots as well? Or
we do. We have both available for the H1N1, the flu mist and the injection.
Is one more effective than the other?
The manufacturer sees it that the body's immune system responds to a live virus and produces more active immunity, so their thought was that it would be better. I don't think they've really proven that, but I'm not taking sides either way, essentially. Yeah. For you, ma'am, I will be giving you the nasal mist. Okay. I think you're a good candidate for it. Did you want to have a seat?
Sure.
Yeah, so this is just a liquid. It's going to go into your sinuses, kind of like a nasal spray. Half in each nostril. I can give you a tissue. You can wipe it if it drips. You just don't want to blow your nose.
How does that feel?
Better than a needle.
Aren't you glad I'm not taking a picture?
Yeah, I know. I'm really glad you don't have a camera.
I know some people.
Hillary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now, Mr. Hicks, you're not feeling sick today.
No.
Which is good. We can still vaccinate patients if they're feeling sick, depending on the degree of the illness. Essentially, we're not supposed to give flu vaccines if we think you might have the flu.
I noticed that you didn't double-check to make sure I wasn't pregnant or breastfeeding.
I didn't double-check, no. And it looks like, based on your age, looks like you'll be a candidate for the injectable inactivated vaccine.
I just turned 50. Can I squeak by?
We have to adhere to the FDA's guidelines.
Okay. Well, I'll have to take my coat off.
It's just a little needle stick. This isn't one of the vaccines that has toxoids, so it shouldn't be as painful as, say, a tetanus vaccine.
That's what they all say.
Yes, well, hopefully I can put my money where my mouth is. Okay.
Okay. You have gotten plenty of practice.
Over the last couple of days, yes. I think yesterday we gave 30 vaccines. About 19 or 20 of those were H1N1.
How many doses do you have?
We requested 200 doses. We weren't sure how much of a response we would get here. They ended up sending us, I believe, 100. I think next week we'll be asking the Department of Public Health for more vaccines, because we'll be running out of them pretty quickly if it keeps going at the rate we're going.
Well, good luck with this.
Thank you.
Thanks
a
lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi. You had a swine flu shot this year?
No.
Are you interested in getting one?
No. I stay away from all vaccines and medicines unless totally necessary.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
Have you guys been vaccinated for swine flu yet?
I have not, no.
Have you?
I have not.
No? Are you going to?
No. I don't feel like I need to. I got the normal flu vaccine, but I'm not at an at-risk population.
And how about you?
It's not something I'm worried about.
Yeah. Have you had the seasonal flu vaccine?
This year I did not. Uh-huh. I used to do that kind of on a every other year type basis because I'd...
Experimental. I agree with him. I had the normal flu this summer. And, you know, it was horrible for a week, but I survived, so it's fine.
Thanks for talking to
thank
me.
You.
Thank
did
you.
Did you have it?
I just got the shot.
All right.
All right, good luck to you both.
You.
Stay healthy.
Here now is George Hicks getting mixed public reaction to the swine flu vaccination. Dr. William Schaffner is infectious disease expert at the Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. He's been guiding us through this story all along. So, Doctor, welcome back. And tell us about the news today of an impending third wave. What does that mean to you?
Well, that means that we've had two early waves in the spring and the fall, very atypical. But now we're entering the usual influenza season. And we're all concerned that both H1N1 influenza and the regular flu strains will become active as we get through January and into February.
Well, but we're getting other conflicting messages. We do hear from the World Health Organization that almost 13,000 people worldwide have died from H1N1. That's terrible news. But on the other hand, we're hearing countries like the U.S., France, Germany have cut down on their vaccine orders. What does that mean to you?
Well, what that means is that plenty of vaccine is now out there. It's not being used as much. And so the countries are saying, oh, hold off, you don't have to manufacture anymore until we use up what we've already got.
Yeah.
And we have vaccine right here in Tennessee, in pharmacies, in doctors' offices, waiting for people to come in with arms.
Or noses, as we just heard.
Or noses.
Well, and so we could have another problem, which is reports like this get out, people start hearing about a third wave, and so they rush to get the vaccine, and new vaccine orders haven't been put in. So there's that. But just remind us, if people are making up their minds right now, some groups are more affected than others. Who are they?
The people we're most concerned about, of course, are individuals who have underlying heart disease or lung disease, who are immunocompromised and the like. But nonetheless, we're now at the stage where the CDC has said, open the doors, let everyone in who wishes to be vaccinated, and we would wish that everyone would wish to be vaccinated.
That's William Schaffner, chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Schaffner, and by the way, we you know, there are people who are going to make their own decision. But you are there on the front lines. And it's been a while since we've seen some of those terrible headlines, you know, college students suddenly rush to emergency rooms with pneumonia and they can't recover because at that point they've become so compromised. Have you seen some of these stories that I think a lot of the public has forgotten about?
Oh, I'm afraid we've seen some of those folks. We've had a 5-year-old come to our emergency room, otherwise healthy, and die in the emergency room. It's true. Most people have 3, 4, 5 days of misery and get over it. But there's the occasional individual among them who gets very sick. So it's still an ominous infection.
Dr. Schaffner, thanks for your time.
Okay, Robin.
And while we have a few seconds, just a reminder that you can always listen to the program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org. If you want to rehear programs like the one you just heard, you can go to the archives or download a podcast and take us with you. That's hereandnow.org. We'll be back with Freedy Johnston in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back.
I know I got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk.
Bad Reputation, one of Freedy Johnston's early hits. Today he releases Rain on the City, his first offering of original material in 8 years. Before we hear that, here's a little reminder of other songs that had critics calling Freedy the songwriter's songwriter.
Dolores was her middle name. She read the book and everything. She has gone to New York City.
Well, on the occasion of the formal release of Freedy Johnston's new work, we thought we'd reprise a conversation we had last summer. He passed through Boston on a tour. And he's kind enough to stop by our studios once you found them wandering around the city. Pretty welcome. Thanks so much for coming in. And how are you?
I'm great.
Now that you're here.
Now that I found the CVS.
Yeah, we're crossing the CVS. But I ask how are you because on at least two tracks on your new CD is the word lonely. Lonely Penny has you commiserating with an abandoned penny that you found on a sidewalk, and Don't Fall in Love with a Lonely Girl. You're lamenting a relationship you can't seem to end with a girl who wants everyone's attention but yours. Is there a reason why the word lonely works in, or is it just a good songwriter's device?
It's just a good word.
Let's listen.
You know I wake up, it's first light. Been sleeping in my chair all night. Just then, on time, she walks in like everything's fine. Don't fall in love with a lonely girl, 'cause you'll never be alone with her. Don't give your heart to a lonely one, 'cause you'll always wonder where she's gone. Don't fall in love with a lonely girl.
Chronicling the lives of lonely, unlucky souls has been one of your trademarks. Is that also just because it makes for good songwriting, or?
You know, I wish I could tell you the truth. You know, I won't be flippant about it, but the songs are the songs.
The songs are the songs.
Yeah, but I didn't live through the autobiographically, the Don't Fall in Love with a Lonely Girl at all. But I'm sure that any of my friends would say that the song came from somewhere if it's not about me.
But is there a genre that maybe you really fit into nicely and some people are very proud to be in, which is the songwriter that could have been a far bigger household name if they had written songs according to formula? New York Times critic Robert Christou called your 1992 release, Can You Fly, a perfect album. 2 years later, you put out This Perfect World. Rolling Stone named you Singer-Songwriter of the Year. And Elektra, your record company at the time, tried to push you towards that, hey, here are the kinds of songs that could get you in the top 40. And the way we read it, you didn't want to go there.
Well, I don't know. That's really kind of not for me.
Is that how you'd write that? Is that how you'd...
No, I'd probably write it more cynically. But I can't write my own bio. Yeah, everybody's going to say, oh, that's that guy that, you know, in 94 he had his biggest hit. But the real story is that, hey, I'm still here. I'm not grousing about it. And I'm really, you know, we just heard three songs from three different eras of my career. As far as I can hear, the new one sounds a heck of a lot better.
Well, let's listen to another one of the new ones. This is Venus Is Her Name. It's a song about a bittersweet reunion of old lovers.
But when we walked along in the falling rain, you know it's been so long, but it feels the same. You're still my girl. She kissed me light and went and sat down. Venus is her name, and she's way out.
Freddie Johnston, remind us where you come from. Kinsley, Kansas, you say so in the middle of nowhere, you had to get a mail order guitar, farmland. In fact, is it true that to finance one of your early albums, you sold off part of the farm that had been in the family for generations?
Well, yes, it is true. That is my story, and I don't want to hide from it or make light of it or, you know, minimize it. But the only money I had is what I inherited. And, you know, my parents are dead, but she found out about that during an interview.
Who did your mom?
My mother. You know, I didn't want to tell her, and so I never told her. So it's not, you know, it's not like some cut and dried thing, man. You know,
it was emotional.
Well, I did it like I was completely the most complete and utter, you know, profligate idiot, you know, and so... Luckily, it turned out.
It turned out okay. Yeah, well, and you're now a guy who maybe had farmland in your ancestry, but now your music...
Now I have music in my ancestry, right? So I'll give my kid a guitar instead of farmland, and if he sells it, then...
Then you'll see
it.
How you feel.
I'll see how I feel, exactly. You sold that guitar.
But your music pays homage to urban life. You know, it feels like, when we listen, it feels like a man walking the streets, looking over, pausing on a bridge...
Well, yeah, I'm definitely the guy who romanticized the city and moved to New York, and it became my magical, mythical place. And that's why Perfect World and Can You Fly, too,
and
a lot of urban images, you know.
I'm thinking of a guy sitting in a train station saying goodbye to someone, as you do in the track Central Station. Let's listen.
On the ceiling,
station, not for wishing those constellations. Tired stone, forgotten glass, weary wood, and faded brass. I'm bound back home, and you can't go. When I'll be back, I don't know.
Is that Grand Central in New York, or just
it was
Andy?
Actually Central Station in Amsterdam, Holland, and the song was set in Holland, but of course it refers to these. And I'm being confusing here.
No, the beautiful. Is the renovated Grand Central Station in Manhattan that has this gorgeous atrium.
Yeah, Grand Central Station has a I don't know how many of the constellations, but they are in the ceiling in electric lights.
Right.
And so that's the image in the song.
But the story's.
The story kind of came from Holland, you know. It was a story that a friend told me. Sometimes that does happen.
Well, let's talk about another song that, you know, happened. The title track on the new CD, Rain on the City. We understand this song happened by accident?
Kind of did. I bought a guitar for my niece, who was 4 at the time. I tuned it up for her, and then she'd taken the 4th from the top, the G string, and tuned it down half a step without me knowing. I guess she was, like, standing there just playing with it.
Yeah.
And I picked it up, and bling, and I don't know exactly what it creates, but it created a, that's where the song came from immediately. I've always thought of it as somewhat magical, though I don't believe in that kind of stuff. It was just amazing. The whole melody came out right then. I've always been very happy about that story because it actually happened. You know, a little kid messed with my guitar and created a song.
Let's listen to Rain on the City.
We will all come down, a peaceful sound, and rise up with the sun. We will gather there up in and fly over everyone. We collide and change and fall again on some city day, and help somebody wash something away.
So Freddie Johnson, you should, you know, like, hand out your guitars to 4-year-olds more.
You are so right, Robin. In fact, I'm going to do that at every show, I think. There'll be a sort of help Freddie write a song session after the gig, so all the kids could just go in there and mess with my tunings and all the, and I'll see what happens.
Magic. That's Freddie Johnston. His new CD is Rain on the City. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Freddie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And again, we spoke with Freddie last summer. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.